Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and tonight, as Hafiz says, the subject, like all nights, will be love, with Marianne Williamson.
My name is Alan Steinfeld, and my program is called New Realities. Each week, I go deep into the understanding of how we can start to change the planet, how new ideas can be presented to the world to unfold a greater civilization.
Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our consciousness, our spirit, our ways of being in the world, where we're awakening to, as my guest says, the presence of the Holy Spirit. So that is why I'm so happy to be here with Marianne Williamson.
Thank you.
And her new book, Tears to Triumph, is a really special book that you wrote because you've created a way of showing suffering and human emotion as a spiritual path. And this probably came out of your own path to awakening in some ways.
Well, I wouldn't say it's about suffering as a spiritual path so much as that suffering is part of the human experience. And when you see the human experience in spiritual terms, then you realize that normal human suffering is part of it. There is a spectrum of normal human suffering. And what has happened over the last few years is that we have medicalized it. You know, mental illness is one thing. Serious mental illness is one thing. Schizophrenia, bipolar, and so forth. And the conversation around psychotherapeutic drugs, for instance, when you're talking about serious mental illness, is understandable.
Right.
But situational despair, you had a bitter divorce, you had a breakup, you lost your job, professional failure, financial loss, the death of a loved one, just being in your 20s. These things are difficult, but they're not mental illnesses.
Right. It's okay to feel a little depressed if you've lost a loved one.
Not only is it okay, it's natural. Sometimes neurosis is best delineated by what people are not upset about than it is by what people are upset about.
That's a good point.
These are very upsetting times. Mm-hmm. Look at what's happening with racial issues in the United States, criminal justice issues, out of control, terrorism, climate change, economic inequality, a presidential election that's disheartening to say the least. If you're not deeply disturbed, I'm concerned about you. So what's happened now is that we have this new psychotherapeutic pharmacological industrial complex that has made a profit center over the fact that people are understandably upset.
So I don't want to get into conspiracies, but do you think it's a conspiracy?
No, it's right out in the open. People aren't noticing, but
right.
It's...
But, you know, the pharmaceuticals make money by prescribing antidepressant drugs, which actually are damaging.
Well, nuances and specifics are important here. First of all, I celebrate, and I'm sure you do too, biomedical research as much as anyone does. I'm not, and also I have no judgment. In fact, I celebrate as much as anyone else the use of psychotherapeutic drugs for serious mental illness where it is helpful. What we're talking about here, which is part of a larger issue of the fact that global capitalism has just swerved out of all ethical center. We have gotten to the point where short-term economic gain is our God. So when you look at something like the overprescription, you know, people say there's an epidemic of depression. What there's an epidemic of is the overmedication of Americans.
Absolutely.
And particularly the overprescription of antidepressants. Mm-hmm. This is part of what you have when you have a market-based healthcare system. Mm-hmm. If we were, let's say, in a country like England or anywhere where there's a universal healthcare system, the investment is getting you off drugs that you don't need. In a market-based healthcare system, the investment is not only getting you on, but keeping you on.
It's a big social problem we have with the way our culture generates its profit. And that's a whole other discussion.
Well, we're living at a time where if it's a public issue, it will get to your private door. Mm-hmm. So this idea that you can put yourself in a little bubble over here and not be affected in some way, and then ultimately some really profound ways, by the larger social, political, economic, moral, and spiritual dysfunctions of our time is a myth. And so information is power. The more you see what's going on in our world, you know, when years ago, if somebody had a problem with a teenager and they would take the teenager to a therapist, the therapist, it became part of mainstream understanding years ago, that the therapist would say, I can't just treat your child. I have to see the behavior of your child within the larger context of your family system. And so today we are expanding our primary psychotherapeutic model has been very much concentrated on the individual drama, the drama of that individual. Now we're expanding to go, you can't understand the drama of an individual today without recognizing the larger order that we're all part of and affected by. And it is not only dominated by fear, which is that's just the consciousness of the human race, but particularly in our society today, minute after minute after minute, we are bombarded by data, by information, and by stimulus that repudiates the truth of who we are. We are spiritual beings, and we are constantly being told, you're not perfect as you are, but if you get this, you might be perfect. If you achieve that, you might be perfect. You might have worth. Other people are not here to collaborate with. They're here to compete with. You've got to make sure you go get yours. The value, the source of your happiness is outside you. By the way, it's a dangerous world out there. And in case you haven't noticed, you are getting older and you're going to die sooner than you'd like. So who's not like this? Mm-hmm. You know, who's not? You know, people say they have an anxiety disorder. Who doesn't? You know?
Well, let's talk about the truth of who we are, because I think, yes, we live within a social fabric that is a disturbed society. Absolutely. But how do we understand the truth of who we are? Because we're not getting that in our schools, in our education, our media. There is the truth of who we are, and it is love, and it's pure, and it's been corrupted.
The issue of who we are is a spiritual issue, and we live in a very overly secularized society. So the life of the inner self is a subject that itself has been trivialized. It's been marginalized. It's been peripheralized in our society. It's not that anyone is doing it to you, but the spiritual path or psychotherapy, personal growth, transformation, this can be a religious pursuit. It can be thought of in spiritual but not religious terms. It can be thought of in secular terms. But it is the idea that there is an inner self, and that inner self is not at home in a world that is chaotic and random. And a world that is chaotic and random outside begins with a world that is chaotic and random inside, and your inner world is random and chaotic unless and until you see love as number one, the identity, who you truly are, your spirit of love, not just your body, and the purpose of your life. You know, we live in a world that tells you have to figure out the source of your happiness as though it's outside yourself. And Buddha said that the things of this world can only bring temporary happiness. Mm-hmm. So everybody's in this struggle and grasping mode to get what they think would make them happy. So you're never really happy because you're going for it. It's over there somewhere. When you get the money, when you get the job, when you get the relationship, then even if you get it, as Buddha said, something outside yourself can only bring temporary happiness. So then even if you get it, the fairy dust will begin to rub off, and then you're in despair, because even having gotten it, it didn't bring you all the happiness you want. So then that same mental mindset says, oh, try to get something else or more of that, and that will fix it. So there are so many ways in which, because we've left the moral center of I am love and my only purpose is to love, we are doomed to the upset and depression and anxiety that emerges from that spiritual and mental fault line.
But isn't that the path of living in the world? Because we come from love. We are love. We are the essence of from where we come from. We come into the world for a spiritual journey in a way to forget, and so it empowers the love. But why do we forget?
But as we were saying, the entire human race, mm-hmm. as we know it, is dominated by a perspective based on fear rather than love. Mm-hmm. And all the great religious and spiritual systems acknowledge this. Buddha, the beginning of his journey to enlightenment, began with his realization that life is suffering. Mm-hmm. The story of the Exodus in the New Testament, the foundational story, is that the Israelites were suffering mm-hmm. as slaves in Egypt, and Jesus suffered on the cross. So all spiritual transmission begins with the realization. All of the great religious systems have at their core the recognition that this world lived outside the light of the divine, outside the light of a sense of our oneness with the Creator, oneness with the universe, oneness with the earth, oneness with each other, and oneness with our own true selves. Any life lived out of the circle of that understanding is painful. Mm-hmm. This is not something new. No. It's not something that the modern mind, we're so arrogant in the modern world, we think we've discovered a disease or something. This is the disease mm-hmm. of human life until we close that gap. Mm-hmm. And that gap, you know, psychic pain is like physical pain. It conveys a message. Humanity would not have evolved over thousands and thousands of thousands of years without being imbued with the capacity to take a hit. Mm-hmm. The physical body has an immune system. If your immune system isn't working, you will not survive. Mm-hmm. The body, because of the immune system, can absorb quite a large amount of injury and disease. Mm-hmm. Psychically, it's the same. You know, humanity has been heartbroken and experiencing catastrophe for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. We have a psychic immune system, and that's mm-hmm. what grief is. Mm-hmm. That's what upset is. That's what remorse is. It doesn't mean something's wrong. If you don't have remorse, you're a sociopath. If you don't have grief, you're not integrating and processing a painful experience. But because we've imposed this business model, the dictates of a business model on the human experience, we see grief like there's something wrong with being sad today. And that's the point. The point is not how do we get out of our sadness. The issue is how do we learn from our sadness? How do we grow wiser about our sadness? How do the lessons of those dark nights of the soul?
And how do we feel it? I mean, I think feeling the sadness to the depth of our being is that natural way of transmuting it.
Yeah, well, that's not what's currently in vogue.
No, but
what's currently in vogue is numbing ourselves to mm-hmm. those deep feelings, distracting ourselves mm-hmm. from those deep mm-hmm. feelings. And also, I remember a time in our society when there was more social mm-hmm. permission given to grieve, to for feel. Instance. So mm-hmm. now we're taking this cheap yellow smiley face, we pour it over everything. Happy, 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 as though there's something wrong with being sad.
But I learned that. I broke up with this woman once, and it's just so painful
yep.
and so heartbreaking. I would feel in my body, and I said, instead of trying to do something bad, I'm just going to track the feeling in mm-hmm. my body. And mm-hmm. when I did that, it started to change. It was my own experiment.
Because you have a natural, once again, mm-hmm. the body knows how to heal itself and the mind knows how to mm-hmm. heal itself. And also, when you have a breakup, a bitter, painful mm-hmm. divorce or breakup, the pain, this is one of the areas where you have to burn through the pain to get to the gain. For instance, 99.9% of relationships that break up mm-hmm. did not involve just one person's issues. So part of the pain of a painful breakup is, if you're mentally and emotionally healthy, mm. being willing to see what part of it was yours.
Mm, exactly.
That's half the pain right there. You know, in Catholicism, they have confession. In Judaism, the holiest day of the year is the Day of Atonement. Mm. In AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, you have to admit the exact nature of your wrongs. Take that fearless moral inventory. After a relationship, what was my part? You have to burn through every cringe, every, if only I'd done this, if I hadn't done that. Mm-hmm. But once again, you need that sleepless night. Don't take a sleeping pill. You need to look at that. Mm-hmm. You need to, those nights, that's why we can't sleep, because you can shoo those demons away during the day more easily. But to burn through that, if you don't burn through that, how are you going to get to the point of knowing, I'm going to be different next time out? I'm not gonna take a man for granted. I'm not gonna take love for granted. I'm gonna be more grateful. I'm gonna be more understanding. I'm gonna be less judgmental. How do you learn except in those dark times? So you have to learn to forgive yourself only through atoning for your errors mm-hmm. and forgiving other people. But if you don't forgive other people when you've been through a painful mm-hmm. situation, then you come out on the other side. You know, it's like you can be bitter or you can be better. And you cannot be happy and be a victim.
Right.
You cannot not take responsibility for your life and be happy. You cannot be a victim and be happy. You cannot withhold forgiveness from others and be happy. Mm-hmm. So this whole thing of depression and sadness, we now recognize you can't trash your body, not care about diet, exercise, just wait till you get sick, and hope that Western medicine can allopathically suppress or eradicate your symptoms. Sickness is the absence of health. Health isn't the absence of sickness.
Right.
Same with happiness and sadness. Sadness is the absence of happiness. Mm. Happiness is not the absence of sadness. You can't just treat sadness. You have to cultivate happiness. And that's, you have to cultivate the capacity to forgive, to atone, to endure, to be patient, to be disciplined, to meditate.
And to feel what you're feeling because of the experience.
Yeah, but I mean, just feeling it. I think the depth of feeling. Yes. However, I think that it's important to realize that if I am wounded, I am feeling the wound. But it's just as important as it is to understand that I must feel the wound. It is equally important to understand I don't have to act from the wound.
Right.
Because some people would say, because I feel angry.
Or because I feel hurt. Yes.
You know, there's discipline. Disciple and discipline come from the same root. That's why in the chapter on Buddha, the Eightfold Path, right speech, right action, right livelihood. So somebody might say, well, because I feel so bad, that's why I wrote that stupid email I'm going to address for the rest of the life.
Without acting out is part of the discipline of being. But on the other side of that, there's a kind of a spiritual syrup, like, oh, let's give it over to God. Like, that will take care. I mean, it's okay to give it over to God, but it stops people from actually going to the depth of
it. Well, I totally disagree with that.
No, when you give it to God, some people think that, okay,
if there's
God
a God,
will
he's
take
at least as smart as we are, Alan. You know what I mean? It's like, so, whoa.
Tell me what you mean.
Okay, what I mean is this. Let's say I'm very, very angry, and somebody just says, I need to feel the depth of my anger. That's very nice, because I do need to feel the depth of my anger. But if I stop there, I am more likely in the middle of the night to send a text, you frickin' son of a bitch. Mm. I am more likely to send the email. I'm more likely to make the phone call, which will only exacerbate the situation and make me feel worse later. To surrender to God by whatever name is to say, I am angry, but by definition, because the essence of myself is love, I am not in the essence of myself. I can't of myself make the bridge between my anger and my love. I don't want to deny my anger, because you're right. It has to come up through a detox, but I want to transcend it. I give it over to the hands of God. I am willing to see this differently. That's what it's about. It's not about denying our upset or our painful emotions, but it is about a willingness to transform them. You know, because there is a difference between denial and transcendence. And then what happens when you say, I am willing to see this differently? You are literally commanding, it's like commanding the forces. And it could be a book, it could be a song lyric, it could be something a friend says, it could be a movie, it could be a TV show, or it could just be a thought that occurs to you. You know what, Marianne? He didn't do everything wrong. And he did make efforts that you're not remembering at this moment. And you did actually tell him to leave. You forgot that part. Do you know what I'm saying? It's our own insanity involved in these things. So when you give something over to God, you are saying, I am willing to think the thoughts that right now my ego mind is keeping me from thinking, and to lessen my attachment to the thoughts that only hurt me.
So what does God mean to you? I mean, you use it a lot, of course, the Course in Miracles uses it, but what is the definition? How do you identify this God being presence for you?
I think AA has it right, God as you understand him, the idea or her or it, the idea of a higher power, the idea of a power that is inside us that can do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Mm. The real spiritual path is where you really get, you're the problem, you're not the answer.
What is the purpose, you think, of incarnation? I mean, it's not to suffer, but suffering is a part. But why? If we come from love and return to love, what is the purpose of being here and separating from that love?
Well, you can't give a rational explanation for an irrational moment. So the separation, which the Course in Miracles says happened millions of years ago in terms of the evolution of the human race, but because time itself is an illusion, we are reenacting it every moment that we close our heart. So we are born ready to just love. Mm-hmm. And we are taught a mindset from the time we're babies that is completely upside down to who we are, where we base our perception of reality on the physical senses rather than the knowing of the heart. My physical senses tell me you're over there and I'm over here. That's what my physical eyes see, when in fact my inner vision knows there's no place where you stop and I start, because we are spirits. My physical ears might tell me, I didn't like what you just said to me, and I didn't like the way you said it. But my inner vision knows that if you weren't telling me something kind and loving, it's just because in that moment, because of your own triggers, because of your own childhood wounds, you didn't know how to download love and get your needs met. So I have a choice. Am I going to base my perception of this interaction on my physical senses, or know that if you weren't loving me, you were just making a call for love, and I can dwell in that attitudinal universe. So when you say, what is the purpose is to remember who we are. Enlightenment is not a learning, it is an unlearning. It is a path of living that many people, millions and millions of people, whether from a religious perspective or a non-religious, non-spiritual, secular, whatever perspective, are getting, that the way we're thinking and living on this planet is increasingly dysfunctional, is increasingly unsustainable. And unsustainable is not an ugly enough word. It means you will die if you continue this way. And we are now living at a time in our country and on our world, on our planet, where the whole thing is unraveling. The whole thing is falling apart. It has to fall apart. The revolution has already begun. The only issue is this going to be a revolution of love, or is this going to be a revolution of fear? There's no escaping these revolutionary times. There's no escaping the upset of it. But it is now each and every one of our opportunity and responsibility to ourselves to make a choice. And you do make a choice every moment. You either make it consciously or unconsciously. Am I using the energy of my mind, my efforts, my livelihood, and my life to proactively move the needle, help move the needle in the direction of a loving change through being the presence of the alternative in whatever field I'm in, as an educator, as an artist, as a scientist, as a business person? Am I the presence of the new alternative, the new possibility, the new more loving way? Or am I crouching into the cage where I've been assigned by myself, by my own ego, and by the world, where I'm so at the effect of my own cowardice and my own narrow thinking that I'm at the effect of the fear of the world, in which case, because there's really no such thing as a neutral thought, my energy is being used in the service of the fear of our times, and good luck with that. Hi, I'm Marianne Williamson, and you are watching New Realities.
So happy to be here with Marianne Williamson, one of the natural inspirations of our spiritual movement. If you were to raise children with their connection to spirit, their connection to their ensouled being, what would that look like?
Well, I think it's not so much that we don't know right now what it would look like. It's that we need to do it. We know, for instance, I've heard a lot of young women, and it's heartbreaking to me. I hear a lot of young women talk these days about, I don't know if I want to bring children into this world with how awful things not only are in certain ways, but could be over the next 20 years, 30 years. And I hope that that's just a phase that people are going through, because we must live in hope, and we must live, you know, every time a baby is born, there's a new possibility. That could be the new genius. And if you honor your incarnation, if you're born in troubled times, that's part of your curriculum for this lifetime. Yes, I think if we made as our bottom line, and this is, I think, women are so important because we should be articulating this. If we made, just think about it, all domestic and international policy, the bottom line was not financial, the financial interests of huge multinational corporations, which it basically is now. But if our bottom line was making sure every child in this country and in this world had what they needed, had what they needed in terms of health, had what they needed in terms of culture, had what they needed in terms of education, had what they needed in terms of parenting.
And in terms of love.
Well, parenting, yes, all of that is an expression of love, either from the culture or from people, for the first 8 years of their life. We would have a completely different planet. We know how to create peace, take care of the children, create economic opportunities for women. So this is, once again, we're not just in denial about the problems. We're coming out of our denial about the problem, but still too often we are in denial about what the answers are. They're right in front of us. And what we need now is the courage. And when you meditate, you know, it's not just what you do, it's who you are while you do it. Everything we do is infused with the consciousness with which we do it. So we need to become the people not only who can discern the answers, but who can embody the energies that are necessary in order to bring these energies forth, to articulate them, to tell truth to power when truth to power needs to be spoken, and to wage the revolution in a loving rather than an angry way so that it actually succeeds.
We're talking about her new book, Tears to Triumph, and I think suffering, as you say, can be used for an evolution.
Absolutely, because everything can be used either by the ego mind, which is the loveless mind, which is the has an underlying intent of suffering, or by the spirit within us. When Buddha realized that life is suffering, this was the beginning of his journey of enlightenment, which culminated in his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree and the state of nirvana. When the Israelites were suffering as slaves in Egypt, that was the beginning of the story. Then they were delivered, went through the 40 years in the desert, ending up in the entrance into the promised land. Jesus suffered on the cross, but that began that three-day journey to resurrection. So that 40 years symbolized in the Old Testament, or the 3 days symbolized in the New Testament, or the period of time that Buddha was fighting the demon of illusion, that means this period of time where we are suffering the craziness and insanity and fear and hatred of the world, but we are, through the changing of our own consciousness, moving into another place. That's where God comes in. So first there's the suffering of the world, then God plays his hand. It culminates in enlightenment, nirvana, promised land, resurrection, which all mean the same thing: self-actualization, inner peace, enlightenment, happiness, a world that works. God will do his part if you do yours. You know, if you, we tend to wake up in the morning. Every great religious system that I've ever read about emphasizes the power of the morning. And we tend to wake up in the morning and go directly for the internet, directly for the television, directly for the whatever, and you download the consciousness of the world and the problems of the world and the stress of the world and the struggle of the world. You just download that, and then you go out into your day. Of course, you're going to be carrying the burden and the anxiety of that stress. On the other hand, if you will purify your heart and mind, just like you wash your body before you go out into the day, then your mind is a vessel for the energies, the thoughts, and the behavior then, the trajectory of behavior that will lead to peace for yourself and others. That is what prayer does. Now, there's no way to get the quote-unquote words right. Nobody's up there going, oh, did you hear those words? He didn't say it right. Just the leaning into God, but whatever that means to you, the meditation, the prayer, and of course, in that book, in my book Illuminata, I'm a prayer person. But, you know, some people don't relate to these things in such a specific way like I do. But in that book, that's, you know, it's not just prayers, it's meditations. Just spending some time in the morning, even 5 minutes in the morning, just send your love before you. Send your love to all the people that you know you're going to see today. Send your love even to the people that you don't know you're going to see today. Surrender your judgments that you're holding, because any judgment is going to deflect the miracles that will otherwise occur. Hand over your grievances, your resentments, because they withhold miracles from you. And so whether you call it prayer, meditation, all of this work, which I tried to put into that book, just little, maybe these words, you know, that's what any author, you're just hoping that something you say makes someone who reads it go, yes, or, you know, we all heal one aha at a time. So I hope that book is filled with the little meditative and prayerful ahas and little ditties that will help people lean into the spirit rather than the ugliness of the times. Okay. You know, in 2008, when we had the recession and the economic downturn, I noticed that the economic stress of that moment was over the top. It spilled over into a real fear that you felt in people that I had never quite experienced before. I mean, we had recessions, but people were really scared. And I remember saying, doing this big free conference call where I said, we need to just have a talk where I just want to lay out metaphysical principles and how they apply specifically to a time like this. And then after the call, I went, you know, I should write this up. This should be a book so that people can read it. And what that deals with is this principle of consciousness, which is that anytime there is a diminishment in the realm of material substance, in the realm of immaterial substance, there is an automatic drive to compensate for it. It's like the universe is like a GPS. If you take a wrong turn, it will just recalibrate automatically to get you to the same destination. And that's what happens when you lose money, that there is a way in which there is an automatic recalibration on the material plane if and when there is a concomitant recalibration on the level of consciousness. So I wanted the issue of the book is, how do you align consciousness with the issue of needing to live in this world with material functionality, which includes the need for money? If I don't pay my bill, then I'm not acting impeccably towards you, because you need me to pay my bill, this invoice for your service, so I can't be in right relationship with you unless I pay you, so I have to make money to pay you. How do I do all that? What's the holiness there? And that's what I wanted to talk about. And the main issue is that when you rise above the turbulence of the world through a serious spiritual path and see the only purpose, you know, Buddha called it right livelihood. When you see the purpose of your efforts in the world, the purpose of your business, the purpose of your worldly efforts, whether you are drawn to the arts or you're drawn to business or you're drawn to sciences or whatever it is, that you dedicate it to love's purposes. That means you are putting it into alignment with the moral order of the universe. And within that space, everything that you need that would support you in rising to your highest level of creative manifestation is automatically magnetized. You know, the purpose of having money is so that you don't have to think about money. So the universe is already set up to provide for you on every level that which would make you most capable of rising to your highest creative manifestation. So that book is about how to dwell within that space, but also how to get back on the wagon when you've fallen out of it through the law of divine compensation. Well, first of all, I've never met anybody who thought this one workshop is going to fix me. I think that's sort of playing people small. I think we go to workshops like you never, if you go to the gym, you never get to stop. You know, you don't go to the gym, see your body the way you like it, and go, well, I don't have to do that anymore. You have to constantly work it. And so some days you'll do Pilates, some days you'll do yoga, some days you'll do weight training, some days you'll do Soul Cycle. So I don't put people down for, you know, it's not always dilettantism. It's that, oh, I hear that teacher is good, or I hear that workshop is good. So that's number one. And what anybody who does go to various teachings will discover is that there is one truth with a capital T spoken in many different ways. So whether it's an AA meeting or a Buddhist meditation retreat, whether it's a Catholic church or a Jewish service, you are going to hear the same universal spiritual themes. And the issue becomes, at a certain point, are you applying them? So all of the great spiritual and religious traditions, including their secular counterparts, are facets of the same diamond. And you're right, there is an immature phase where, oh, it's confronting me, I'm going to go to the next one. And then it's confronting me, I'll go to the next one. But as we mature, we come to understand, no matter where I go, they're going to tell me some of the same things, and I'm going to have to apply it. I do think when it comes to the modern spiritual movement, the era of data collection is over. At this point, it's not just about gathering information. It's about how to apply the information more deeply. So you still go to the workshops, you still read the books, but knowing that it's not going to tell you something you didn't already know, but it will hopefully help you apply more deeply the things that you do already know. Well, I mean, we can talk about love, love, love all we want, but if you haven't forgiven your ex, we can talk about love, love, love all we want, but if you know in your heart you should get back to that person, if you know in your heart you're not rising to the occasion in your own job or your own relationship, if you know in your heart you're not taking full responsibility and being impeccable in your own circumstances, it's not that you need new information, you need to apply the information that you have.
So you think we're
so you leave out the second part and you've got to...
No. I think we're moving to that, because here we're in this time of suffering where the promised land is out there. I think, and you started with the Department of Peace and the work you've tried to do and politics and all that, that we can move to an enlightened society. Do you see that as a vision?
It's very important that we not forget. Look at the journey of the United States. Mm-hmm. We have in many ways transgressed against our own most cherished principles, genocide of the Native Americans, slavery, and so forth. But when you look at our political journey, we are a country that had slavery, then we are a country that abolished slavery. Mm-hmm. Women didn't have the right to vote, and then the women's suffrage movement gave us the right to vote. There was institutionalized white supremacy, and then there was the civil rights movement. Gay people had no right to marry, and then there was the struggle for marriage equality. But the point is, where would we be today if abolitionists hadn't been upset about it? Mm-hmm. Where would we be today if Susan B. Anthony had just known how to chill? You know, like, girl, don't create so much drama wherever you go. What is this new emotional flatline that everybody talks about like it's some kind of high spiritual order? It's not. The fact that these are disturbing times, this is how society moves forward. Abolitionists were not okay with slavery. Those women suffragists were not okay with women not being able to vote, and so forth. So when we have these times of what author Paul Hawken calls blessed unrest in ourselves and in our world, We are part of a larger evolutionary drive forward. So is it possible? Yes. And that's what's so important about these times. Let us not be the first generation of Americans who wimped out on doing the job that needed to be done to take a country and a planet that has so swerved from its ethical center and put it back on track. Admittedly, these are difficult times. These are difficult ones. It's not like there are easy answers.
Right.
But I wouldn't say abolitionists exactly had an easy job. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that women suffragettes had an easy job. And in every area, whether you're talking about criminal justice, racial issues, the fact that our democracy itself has become so rigged, the fact that even climate change, even with ISIL and international terrorism, if we do the deeper work, atoning for where we have made mistakes, which is an important part of it, you can't heal your own life and you can't heal the world without atoning for the mistakes, understanding how we got here, and then looking in all of those areas that I just mentioned, there are brilliant people who know what to do, who stand for the alternatives, who show best practices. The problem is they're not usually financed by our governments, because our governments are so often handmaidens to the other forces whose money is to be made on the things not getting better and so forth. This is not a time to be numb. This is a time to be awake. This is a time to be educated. This is a time to read. This is a time to think. This is a time to pray. This is a time to meditate. And we all do that and we'll kick ass and change this thing and everything will absolutely be fine.
I have great hope for this planet. That's why I do this program. That's why speakers like you are so impassioned. It's getting the word out, and it is making a change. We are affecting the consciousness. Something's shifting, and that's what's raising the problems to the surface, because we have to see the darkness, as you say, in order for the light to come. Or you think it's not?
No, it is, but I don't think this is a moment when the spiritual community can be in a self-congratulatory mood.
No, I'm not congratulating. There's a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But I think that there's a little deeper to go with that. Part of the shadow side of the spiritual movement is the denial of our own shadow. I think that if you have a clue as to what changes one heart, you do have a clue as to what changes the world. So we have a lot to contribute. I think that the people in the spiritual community are the last people who should be sitting out the great social and political issues of our day. And so I think that we have to tend to that.
Absolutely.
I think it's beginning to happen, but I think, you know, it's not like we don't all know the principles now. Mm-hmm. We've kind of articulated them. Everybody's read the same book. I think now we need to, with each other, really not so much ask you what your disorder is ask you if you meditated today and if you've forgiven. You know, too many times if people go to therapy today and you have a problem with your relationship, how many times will the therapist say, is this relationship really giving you everything you need? When the question the therapist should be asking is, are you really giving this relationship everything you have?
Right.
Or too often you go somewhere today into a conversation with a counselor or someone and you say you're upset. Not enough counselors or friends will then say, who haven't you forgiven? Mm. We're still putting it too much like, you know, making ourselves.
Well, that's what's so good about your work. It's doing the personal work. Yeah. Where have you not forgiven people? Where have you not acknowledged the shadow? And that's a spiritual path.
That's right. And rising to the occasion and taking responsibility for your part and holding yourself accountable and just growing up. We have a crisis of adulthood in the United States. Too many men are still acting like boys, and too many women are still acting like girls.
So what do you suggest?
I think it's happening. I just think we all need to step it up a little.
Mm-hmm.
When we were children, we were taught the theory of evolution. And we were taught that if a species was practicing behavior that was basically maladaptive for its survival, that one of two things would happen. It would either go extinct or it would evolve. A mutation would occur. And even though the mutation did not represent the majority of the species at that time, because the behavior of the mutation was better adapted for survival, the descendants of the mutation would survive. So those were the two options, extinction, evolution. We have come to a point as a species where our collective behavioral patterns, both in terms of how we treat the planet and how we treat each other, are maladaptive for the survival of our species. We will either go extinct, and there are many ways we could throw ourselves off this planet, or we will evolve. The great religious and spiritual figures, whether they're Buddha, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, all the great religious systems, carry foundational stories as well as spiritual transmissions that are the evolutionary alternative for humanity. So this evolution of consciousness, by whatever name you call it, by whatever path, represents the need and the deep, deep desire on the part of the human race at this time to evolve in a sustainable direction. And it's a deep, deep sense of knowing that something is very, very wrong, that is the greatest blessing, because it is an internal warning system. And that's a good thing. Somebody was telling me a story. Oh, I saw this on television the other day. It was a gentleman who was present. It was in Dallas, Texas, where the police shootings occurred. And there was a gentleman who was walking towards the area where it happened. He was an African-American man. And he said his dog stopped and would not move. He had a dog on a leash, and the dog planted himself. And simply he said, come on, and the dog would not move. And he couldn't, and it was a big dog, so he couldn't pick it up. And the dog wouldn't move, and within 5 minutes, if he had continued walking, he would have been in a very problematic area. It's interesting, the dog knew. We all know that something must change now, and we are being called within to evolve within ourselves so that we can help evolve the world.
Okay. And how do you feel like, I think you were talking about kind of like the market approach to our society, but
yeah,
there's also the technological approach, and people think that technology is going to solve our issues, and the idea of transhumanism will just make ourselves better and we can fix things. Can you address that in terms of personal growth?
The technological revolution, like anything of the material world, is itself neutral. Whether it is holy or unholy, whether it is helpful or unhelpful, totally has to do with the consciousness of the human beings using it. You can look at the internet. You can look at the extraordinary good it does. We can also talk about some of the horrible threats that it poses at certain times in certain ways. So it's not about the technology. It's about the human consciousness which uses it. So, and this, you know, this is not new. This goes back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. It in many ways, if you look at the Industrial Revolution, and that's all that the modern technological revolution is, its child, right, is the ultimate culmination, really, of the Industrial Revolution. In many ways, it has brought great, great good to the planet. In another way, however, it has been part of the great peripheralization of the inner forces, the great trivialization of the inner life, because it's made us so, we're so mesmerized by the outer. So technology is the same. It of itself will not bring forth the greater good. It can also be used to put a lot of people to sleep. It can, and it does do that as well. It has to do with the human heart and the human mind and how it uses it.
There's one part in this book where you talked about in your depression, there was a presence that sat with you in the room. And then you said, after you were kind of better, you said, go away. There was more to that story that I wanted to hear. Can you talk about that a little bit?
It was when I was in my late 20s. I went through a personal tragedy. And it was a very, very, very difficult time in my life. And I worked with a really brilliant psychiatrist. And I was a student of the Course in Miracles. It was all quite amazing. And I felt during that time, very painful year, and it felt like my skull had been smashed into thousands of pieces. Mm. And very slowly, very surely, it came back together. And the two things I wanted to talk about in the book were if you do see your pain of the of a depressing time in the context of spiritual growth, mm-hmm. miraculous changes can happen during those times. I know after that year, mm-hmm. my career started soon thereafter. Something came into my head when my skull came back together. Is how it felt? Something was in here that hadn't been there before. And I've read so many stories of people like that. That's why if I had just been treated like I was, like if I had been...
chronically ill.
Or
Or numbed out.
Like numbed out.
Yeah.
Which was certainly offered.
Right.
So during that time, and you know, why would you look to a corner of the society to heal you during a time like that? If that corner of the society doesn't even acknowledge the soul, why would you look to them to solve a spiritual crisis? Yeah. It's a crisis of your soul, the dark night of the soul. The other thing that you're referring to there is that I did have a sense of a kind of mystical presence with me during that time. I go into it in the book. And then when I started to feel better, I still felt this presence. Mm-hmm. And it had been very comforting to me when I was going through it. But when my life started coming back together, I felt it kind of encroaching. And I had said during that time of my horror, I'd said a prayer, "Dear God, if you give me my life back, then I will do anything you want for the rest of my life." But then once I started to get better, you know, I was like, "Thank you very much. I really appreciate that you were here and that you helped me, but like, I'm really cool now and I know that you have a lot of people you could help." I was like dismissing God and telling him he could go now. And then I tell in the book about a daydream, hallucination, whatever, vision, whatever I had when I was at a cocktail party one night. And I wandered into this room and there was a group of men, a small group of men, and they were all in tuxedos and they had drinks in their hands. And one of them turned to me. This was a few months after I'd said, "If you would just give me my life back, I will do anything you want." But then I had started dismissing God, like whatever this presence is, like, kind of creepy now. And this man turned to me, and obviously I was daydreaming. It was like the visage of Jesus.
Right.
It was a God thing. And he looked at me, and without any sense of attitude, any sense of reproach, any sense of anything other than completely neutral, he said, "I thought we had a deal."
So what did that do for you?
It changed. That was it for me. I knew that I'd when people ask me, "How did your career start?" I always think of that night at that cocktail party. That was the moment.
That's very touching. It is beautiful. Moving. Thank you. We're running out of time. So let's do a little, can we do, because you're such a great speaker.
Thank you.
And the presence of your prayer is really powerful. Can we send a prayer out to the world that will encourage us to take better action, to atone for our sins, and to make a better world without forgetting our suffering?
You want the whole thing?
I want the whole thing in one prayer.
To the Holy Source, by whatever name, and to the greater light, the creative source of our being, we pray. Knowing that of ourselves, of our own human consciousness, we have been brought to this place that now brings us to our knees. We place in holy, divine, godly hands all the torment and the suffering of all sentient beings, the problems of our time, the stresses on our planet, racial inequities, criminal justice inequities, all the ways in which things are wrong, things are off, the planet is not thriving. We know that you cannot do for us, dear God, what you cannot do through us. And so we place in your hands our lives, all that we have and all that we are. Use us. Use our strengths and use our weaknesses. Use our successes and use our failures. Use our bodies, use our minds, our spirits, all that we have and all that we are. May we become the people that you would have us be, that we might do as you would have us do, that through us you might heal our precious world. It is to this that we surrender ourselves, this cause, this goal. And so it is. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you.
So it's only when we're brought to our knees can we raise ourselves up and be changed by that intensity of feeling that we...
Well, you know, you gotta have a big, if you're going to have a big building in the sky, mm-hmm. there's got to be a big hole in the ground first. And this is not to glamorize suffering.
No.
You know, it's not like you have to suffer, but in order to come to consciousness, mm-hmm. I don't believe. But I think it's true if most of us are honest with ourselves, we have chosen that way. But hey, through the, you know, every mm-hmm. generation stands on the shoulders of the one mm-hmm. before it. So hopefully through reading, through learning mm-hmm. from others, we can learn to be wise by mm-hmm. learning from other people's experiences and not having to crash and burn ourselves so often.
And we're shaped by our experiences and
our joy.
And our pain.
All of it. It's all part of being human.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you.
For your beauty and your courage
Thank
to
you.
Say what needs to be said.
Thank you.
And to write a book that will help people move through their pain and see that we're all part of the Holy Spirit. That we are
by whatever name we call it. You know, I'm a right. Jewish girl. And so,
I'm
you know.
A Jewish person too. yeah.
By whatever name we call it.
But the Holy Spirit is the God divinity within.
Absolutely. Nirvana, resurrection, yes. Holy Spirit. So, go to marianne.com for more information.
Right. No, there's so much more. And we'll do more. We'll do more.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.